David Green, thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
Now, our listeners know you best these days for co-hosting Morning Edition, but you were also a political reporter and the Moscow bureau chief for NPR for several years. Russia seems like a world away from those positions in the United States. Why did you decide you wanted to go?
You know, I spent 8 years covering the White House, 4 for the Baltimore Sun as a print reporter and 4 for NPR, and I feel so lucky to have done that job. I mean, I really feel like I had a window on history. But after 8 years, you know, I kind of wanted to flex different muscles, and it always dreamt of being a foreign correspondent. And so the job of Moscow bureau chief was open, and I just dove at it. And my wife, Rose, and I had a lot of conversations about whether this was the right time for an adventure like this. She was leaving a really good job working for New York City Council, but we decided to take this dive together, and off we went. And you know, I'm really happy I did it because it was just a fascinating time.
Your new book, Midnight in Siberia, follows you on, this is your second 6,000-mile trip on the Trans-Siberian.
Only 6,000 miles. Only 6,000
miles. Only 6,000 miles. why did you decide to make that trip again, especially, you know, during such a turbulent previous couple of years in Moscow and across different parts of the country? Why go again?
Well, you know, because the story, you know, I wondered if the story was changing and if this would be yet another moment to kind of try and capture Russia in any way I could by listening to people. And I'll be totally honest with you. When I got back from Russia, I sort of settled into my job here at Morning Edition, and a friend of mine, a book agent, came, and he had worked with first-time authors before, and I'd heard really good things about kind of him taking first-time authors through the process. And he came to me and said, I think this train trip would be a wonderful book. And I said, well, Howard, I think you're crazy because I'm in this new job and I'll have no time for it. And he had me write just a page, kind of one memory of the first train trip, and then he had me write 5 more pages, and I totally saw that he was manipulating me and trying to get me to write a book proposal, and I just let it happen, and he went and sold the idea to Norton, the publishing house. And I don't know, I think I didn't realize it. I think Howard, my friend and agent, had to draw it out of me, but you know, I'd done radio, I love radio, I don't want to do anything else, but to be able to take, you know, 5 weeks and go to a place without a microphone and just be a writer and kind of look at things and think about how I would craft words just was an irresistible opportunity. And I learned so much about writing and kind of the experience, and, you know, learned a lot about myself and my voice, and I have so much more to learn. But it was just flexing different muscles and trying something new, and it was really neat.
A lot of folks consider traveling by rail a romantic experience, but you know, when we think of Siberia, at least in the West, you know, I think we think of the Gulag, we think of a cold, desolate place. Was this a romantic trip? I mean, you were in second and third class cabins on very crowded trains sometimes.
Well, you know, my wife and I disagree about whether cold and desolate can be romantic. I think that there's a poetry to, you know, cold, desolate places, and to watch people in incredibly cold places get along and get by, you know, there's something incredibly powerful about that. And the farther you get into remote places, you know, you begin, I feel like, to see smaller battles happening. And by smaller battles, I mean it's not taking to the streets and fighting for democracy, but it might be, you know, a small business owner who is just doing anything she possibly can to avoid bribes and to avoid having to pay fines in a corrupt government that's probably out to make money any way it can. Just little battles fighting the system, and you just feel this bit of more revolutionary spirit out in remote Siberia. And there's something inspiring about that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because, I mean, you traveled from Moscow in the West to Vladivostok in the East, and you talked with folks all along the way. I mean, that's a vast expanse. You know, how did you see the culture and the people change as you, you know, moved slowly from West to East?
Well, I'll answer that in two ways. The farther you get from Moscow, I mean, once you get into the Far East and start getting towards Vladivostok, you're closer to Japan, you're closer to China, you're closer to North Korea, the sense of connection to Moscow, I mean, just starts to totally disappear. People, if they go on vacations, they might go to South Korea. They might go to some of the islands off the coast of eastern Russia. You know, it's just not this, it doesn't feel like Europe. But as you move farther out, you realize that there's this truth about Russian culture that has been there for a long time, that the people and the state are very, very separate. And there's just not always this feeling that people have that I can affect change. And the you know, when you're outside of Moscow, you know, you do find people who are just, they're more desperate for some sense of stability. It's not like you hear voices everywhere calling for Vladimir Putin is this great leader, but it's kind of this fear of the outside world. There's this fear of what people have seen in the Arab Spring, and there's this sense of fatigue. And just, you know, there's been all this upheaval. We're out here living 3,000 miles away from Moscow. Just let us live our lives.
That's really interesting, because I think when a lot of us saw the dissolution of the Soviet Union, when that fell apart, you know, we thought we were looking toward a, you know, a friendlier, more prosperous, a new Russia. But,
yeah.
You know, Putin seems like a very much a throwback to the old days, and there seems to be almost a nostalgia, I guess, in your book and in some of your reporting from some folks for the Soviet times, for old times. Is that really the case? Has democracy, has capitalism failed the average Russian?
I'll put it this way. The democratic experiment that Russians feel like they went through in the Boris Yeltsin years, a lot of Russians feel like that was a failure. And Vladimir Putin, for all of, you know, kind of the downsides of him and his leadership style, he has lifted the average Russian up economically during his time in power. And, you know, Russians give him credit for that. And so, you know, there is a hesitation to sort of go to democracy if it could mean going back to the experiment that you saw in the Yeltsin years. And I grew up as the Soviet Union was ending, and, you know, as a kid in the United States, I was like, okay, they're just going to be on this inevitable path to democracy. It's just a matter of time. And I went into Russia, you know, before I got to know this country, thinking I was going to find people where I would say to them, like, why don't you get it? You know, why aren't you fighting for change? And the story is just so much more complicated. I mean, there's so many stereotypes that Russians will actually joke about. Russians will say, oh, you know, you Americans think that we're just lazy alcoholics who don't care about our country. Absolutely not true. And that comes across you very quickly when you start to meet people.
Are folks trying to make change on a local level, or is it simply about just getting by?
It's often getting by, and it's often these smaller battles that you do see. I mean, one fight kind of stands out to me. It was in the village of Sagra. These villagers got in a street battle. It was sort of like the showdown at the OK Corral with a criminal gang, and they were defending their village. And the local authorities charged the villagers with hooliganism. And in Russia, once you're charged with something, very likely that's the end. You're going to be convicted, period. And a young man whose father was wrapped up in this, you know, got an attorney and sort of publicized what was happening and was able to turn this on its side and to, you know, to get the local authorities off the backs of these villagers. And he said to me, publicity was our protection. And so there's a small battle right there. And I asked him, you know, isn't that a democratic value? Isn't that, you know, show that that's sort of that you appreciate what I appreciate as an American? And he said, absolutely not, because there's a Russian mentality that needs to be protected as well. And, you know, he said, I don't want your system. And so you can see that there are ways to sort of experiment with the kind of values that we have and appreciate here, but that doesn't necessarily mean Russians are getting ready to dive across the line and say, give me what the United States has. So it's very complicated and nuanced.
I'd like to pivot, if we can, to current events just briefly, because, you know, we've been hearing your reporting from Crimea, which Russia annexed earlier this year. It looks like a pretty clear win for Putin, but what were the attitudes of the Crimean people while you were visiting?
I would say a few things. You know, there was a referendum that Russia held, and Russia, back in the spring, Russia claims that 97% of Crimeans supported a Russian takeover. There was more than 120% turnout in one city, which gives you a sense of how fair that election probably was. And so, you know, many in the West thought it was sort of laughable. That said, you know, based on spending 10 days there, there are a lot of Crimeans who are thrilled to be back in Moscow's embrace. And a lot of them say some of the very things we were talking about. This world is so dangerous. Look at the violence in eastern Ukraine and the upheaval there. The world is so unpredictable. The Ukrainian government, a lot of people feel like, corrupt and, you know, did nothing for people in Crimea in a lot of people's eyes. So there's a lot of celebration to be back with Russia. Now, there are also quietly, you hear a lot of voices, pro-Ukrainians, who have sort of slipped back into the woodwork. Many of them have left, but you talk to some of them more quietly. They don't want microphones stuck in their faces, but in bars and cafes, and they're sort of in shock. They feel like this is some sort of nightmare playing out. Like, how are we now part of Russia? How do we now have to go, you know, get Russian citizenship? And then the third story, and a very powerful one, I think, is the Crimean Tatars that we've actually been focusing on a lot. This is a Muslim minority in Crimea. They were deported by Stalin in World War II, violently so, thrown in boxcars, sent to Central Asia. Many of them died. They fought to come back to Crimea in the 1980s and live through times, you know, in Ukraine, feeling closer to the West. They are being pressured now again. Young Tatar men have been disappearing, a handful of them. No one knows who has kidnapped them. Tatar leaders have been deported and sent out of Crimea. Tatar offices, libraries have been closed. So it is stunning and painful to watch a community that was persecuted during Soviet times go through something that strikes them as sort of history repeating itself in a very, very sad way.
During your time as Moscow bureau chief and your time taking these trips, how did your view of the Russian people change, and did Russia change you at all?
I think it did. I mean, you land in Moscow as an American, and you just feel like there are fewer smiles. They're not showing their emotions on the streets. There's just this kind of coldness. And then you spend time getting to know people in their homes, in their apartments, and in their lives, and they are some of the warmest people on earth. And I think that applies to the whole country for me. You know, I arrived, it was cold, it was mysterious, it was unfamiliar, and as I got to know it, I really saw the warmth. And whatever people say about Vladimir Putin, whatever people say about kind of the future of this country, I loved it. I mean, I just felt really lucky to spend a few years there. And, you know, you go into someone's home and they have slippers ready for you. You take off your shoes, you sit down. They'll probably have a spread of tea and vodka and food that they've been making all day for you. And you'll just sit there for hours chatting in some warm place. And, you know, and it's cold and kind of ominous outside. And there's just a beauty and a poetry to that that I really miss.
David Green is co-host of Morning Edition and former Moscow bureau chief for NPR. His new book is Midnight in Siberia. David, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Sean. I really appreciate that, and thanks for having me on. It was great talking to you.